Hello again. It's Friday. That means another edition of Zogby Report, real and unscripted. And as always, I'm John, and I'm here along with my son and partner, Jeremy. How you doing this week?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing just fine, and I'm doing especially fine because we get to welcome a good friend, and I must say a legendary figure in the world of political strategies, Jerry Austin from Ohio. So let me tell you folks a little bit about Jerry Austin, and then we're going to jump right into it. Jerry has just got a who's who of political clients over the years, names like Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama, Paul Tsongas, Carol Moseley Braun, the first African-American woman elected to the Senate, Paul Wellstone, John Glenn, and it goes on. He was the chief political strategist in 1988 for Reverend Jesse Jackson. He's been an international elections monitor, co-founder of the Bliss Institute of Politics at the University of Akron, where he teaches, and is the author. He's the author of a few books and a new one coming out, but the one we're going to talk about today, I'm just going to show you, is True Tales from the Campaign Trail. It's a wonderful book collection, not of essays, more importantly, a collection of stories, which we're going to talk about. Welcome again, Jerry, and let's get right to basics here. You're a political strategist. For those who think they know, and for many who really honestly don't know, what is a political strategist? I mean, what is it that you do for a campaign for a living?
Try to figure out how to get somebody elected, how to win an election based upon who that candidate is, where they're running, what they're running for, what kind of money they have to spend or the ability to raise. Is this an area where TV is dominant? Is it more of a radio district? Is direct mail a possibility? Obviously, the internet is involved. And you try to tell their story. I mean, my book that you referenced is a book of stories that people have told me. But if you think about it, John, you know, you and Jeremy are the same business. You're going to get a client. You're going to tell that client your story, who you are, what you've done, why they should hire you. And for me, if they hire me, I'm going to tell their story to the people mm-hmm. in their district, in their state or whatever, to get them elected. And that's basically what a political strategist does. I basically started off managing campaigns. I was tired of supplying ideas for TV and radio spots to the consultants, and I decided that I'd do that as well. So I wound up doing TV, radio, direct mail, all the kind of communications that are involved in trying to get somebody elected.
Let's build on that for a second and go even further back. How did you get involved in this world? Were you an advertising agency, a marketing person, always politics?
No, I grew up in a place called the Bronx, accent on the. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a family that was not active in politics, but active in union issues. And although, you know, New York is a very democratic city. So my involvement in politics was what my parents were involved in unions, whether it was civil rights or it was anti-war or whatever it was. And I became a teacher, and I, you know, went to demonstrations. I volunteered campaigns. And one day some guy said, I want you to quit your job and run my campaign, and I'll pay you. I never heard that before. And I thought he said, I'll pay you $5,000 which he did say, but I thought he meant $5,000 a month. He meant $5,000, period. And I had a job and basically, ran a campaign, and he became lieutenant governor of Ohio, a guy named Dick Celeste. And I went in to become chief of staff. But it was a joke because the lieutenant governor at that time was not elected in tandem. So he was a Democrat. The governor was a Republican. The only responsibility he had was only vote in the case of a tie, and to be commander-in-chief of the Ohio Navy, which didn't exist. So after 3 years of doing that, I wound up being recruited by somebody to run a statewide campaign, Secretary of State, and knocked off a 28-year incumbent. And so the rest is history, and I've done since then, and never looked back on making a living being a consultant.
And I have to add, in Ballotpedia, just so that folks know, you are listed as one of the all-time great political strategists in Ohio history. And so I just thought folks should know that. You just, up to the point of becoming chief of staff to the lieutenant governor, pretty much told my story. I was a teacher and got into politics, and mine wasn't $5,000. My first poll was $500, but basically it ended in the same place. Is our story pretty typical? Let's say there's college students who are listening right now, or career changers listening out there. I mean, how do you become a political strategist? What would you tell them?
First of all, our generation, which I call Generation Extra, got involved in politics the way we did. We didn't go to school and say, I want to be a political consultant, I want to be a pollster. You know, it didn't exist. So now you can actually major in all these things with a specialty in digital, a specialty in media, a specialty in journalism. There are all sorts of opportunities in colleges right now to major in very different subjects that lead you right to, putting or into advertising. That wasn't available when I began doing this.
I get asked all the time, and I wonder if you agree. I tell people, regardless of what their major is, take as much history, as much literature, read as many novels as you possibly can to get the insights into not only the complexity of human beings, but more so how stories are told, how you develop real characters or fictional characters. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, but what I tell young people is go get involved in a campaign. I don't care whether the campaign is a precinct committeeman or school board or something. Get involved as a volunteer and find out if you want to volunteer even more because you're excited about what you're just seeing and learning. That's what happened to me. I mean, I volunteered in the campaign, and I was a driver for the candidate, which is the greatest volunteer job you can have, to drive the candidate, because you spend time with the candidate, you get to know the district. And I loved it. And I couldn't wait for my job, my paying job, to end, to go volunteer in a campaign, because it was exciting. But the other thing is that I always tell people that one of the reasons I got involved in this profession is that I'm a frustrated athlete. I mean, I was all schoolyard in my neighborhood in the Bronx, so I found out that basketball was played indoors and not outdoors. And then I suffered from severe white man's disease because I couldn't run, I couldn't jump, and I couldn't shoot. But politics provided for me what sports did. You have a season. The season ends on election day. You get a report card. You do scouting, polling, and then you get a report card, and if you win most of the time, people will hire you. If you lose most of the time, people won't hire you. So I like the competition. There's nothing like election day in a campaign. It's usually, what's going to happen. But on very occasions, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it happened to me with Carol Moseley Braun. the first African-American woman to be elected to the U.S. Senate, but she beat an incumbent Democrat in the primary. Never, you know, it just was unheard of. And I had I had one of these feelings of maybe, but I wasn't sure. And she beat him, which is a huge upset. Same thing happened with Paul Wellstone. He ran against the two-term incumbent. He got outspent $7 million, $700,000, and you think you hit a responsive chord, and then you did it, and they won. So now you can't appreciate winning unless, of course, you lost, and certainly. You know, losing, is something you don't want to happen, but it happens.
Yeah, just to move back to earlier point that you made about getting involved in campaigns, because I believe that as well. And I warn students, don't get involved. Don't say, I want to be your communications person or I want to be your strategist. I'm going to test you on this term, the Jimmy Higgins in the campaign. That's an old left-wing term. That's the person who stands out in the rain handling pamphlets. That's the person who does the driving. That's the person who knocks on doors and gets accustomed to most people slamming the door in your face. It sounds to me like you have a lot of that in your background as well, because I certainly...
Yeah, the thing, I remember, this is a story. I'm driving. I'm the driver for the candidate. He's a state rep, and he said to me, "I want you to wear, a sport jacket, and no bell bottoms, no sandals, you're gonna accompany me." And after the night's over in campaigning, we're gonna go to a working class bar and end the night because. I want to show these guys that I understand, what working class guys are all about. So we're walking into this bar, and he says to me, you're from New York. I don't want you ordering any of those fuzzy navels or Tom Collins or any of those foo-foo drinks. You either order a beer or a shot in a beer. Okay, you got that? I said, okay. We walk in the bar. He orders a beer. The bartender says to me, what will you have? I said, I have a shot in the beer. And there's a pause. I thought he didn't hear me. I said, I have a shot in the beer. And he said, excuse me, but a shot, you got to tell me a brand. A shot's not a brand. You got to give me a brand. Well, I never had a drink of liquor in my life. And so I said, Jack Daniels. And he looks at me, he says, Jack Daniels, but most people order Rotka kind of booze. Where you get Jack Daniels from? I said, well, Frank drinks it. I said, Frank who? I said, Frank Sinatra. And that's how I ordered my first drink.
That's funny. And that is a typical kind of story that you find in this wonderful, wonderful book. You have friends and colleagues from many years who've contributed to this book, True Tales from the Campaign Trail. I have to admit to you, I'm a sucker for Louisiana and Louisiana politics. That of the 50 states, and we're from New York, right? But of the 50 states, that really has to be the most colorful of them all. Tell me a little bit, because you have a bunch of essays from Ray Strother. Tell me a little bit about Ray Strother, what kind of guy he is, and what he brings to the table.
Well, Ray is a couple years older than me, and I always accused him of inventing political consulting as we know it today, back making a living, having a firm and all that. And he grew up in West Texas, and he went to Louisiana State, and he wound up getting involved in Louisiana politics, and I dedicate this book to him, and also I have many of his stories because he has great stories and he tells them really well. And it's just, as you said, Louisiana is, anybody who's listening to this lives someplace where there's probably a county sheriff. Well, in Louisiana, the counties are called, God, I just lose my Parishes. I'm sorry, Parishes. Yeah. And he's got a story there about a county with the sheriff in the parish. Is 5 foot tall, 10-gallon hat, and 6 shooters, and owns the 2 whorehouses in town, and makes sure all the elected office holders have freebies at the whorehouses, so we can film them and basically, you know, blackmail it for something he wants. Well, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And Louisiana's one incredible story after another. And if you think, how can this happen in one place? Well, that's because it's almost, to be successful down there at a certain time, you had to do all these crazy things. And Ray basically tells the story of Louisiana in particular and other places, that he's done stuff. But, you know, people who are in this book are great storytellers. And, you know, they may write a TV spot that's 30 seconds or 60 seconds. They may be a direct mail piece, but you can tell that these folks are great storytellers. And that's what it's all about. I mean, isn't life about storytelling? I mean,
it is.
You know, it
really is, you know. And one of the things that, you know, I worry about in my field of polling, obviously we do data and we quantify that data, and that's important. You know, you need to know, are 60% with you or 58% like you, how many dislike you and intensely dislike you. But, you know, ultimately what we do try to find in those numbers, as you know, is the story of people. You know, that there are X and Y chromosomes and 1s and 0s in computer programs, but ultimately we're just the composite of our life experiences, some of them very interesting, some of them very touching, some of them that illuminate who we are to other people. What do you look for? I mean, what's your methodology for when you get hired by a candidate or when you decide which candidate to represent? How do you find their story?
Well, first of all, I ask them to tell me their story. First, I tell them my story. Mm. I tell them, you know, where I came from and just basically my life story. Then I ask them to do the same. And I'm listening for things in their life story that I can basically translate that into a TV spot or a direct mail piece. But most of the time, I initially would do a bio brochure, a direct mail piece that is very, very, very a little on verbiage and lots of pictures. And I believe in telling somebody's life story with pictures, and everybody's mm-hmm. got the pictures, and I tell them to go, you know, put all the albums on a dining room table, give me 3 hours, and I go through them all, and I pick out pictures, and then I ask them to tell me a story of those pictures. And, you know, everybody's got a story. Some are more interesting than others. Some have overcome, you know, great hardships, and others have, you know, have something else in their story that you wanted to pick. Now, if the person is running for attorney general, for instance, or a county prosecutor, obviously the person is going to be a lawyer, and you need to talk about, you know, that part of their background that makes them qualified to be for this job. Or a person is running for the first time for anything, you know, why are they running for state? Why are they running for city council? What are they going to bring to the table? Are they running against an incumbent, or is this an open seat? Are you running in a primary, or is this a general election? All those things factor into it. But basically, the really good political consultants, they all have one thing in common: great instinct. Just great instinct. You know, that they hear something, they see something, and I remember just a story. I don't know if it's in the book or not. I don't remember, but I did the race of the first woman ever to run for governor of the state of Oklahoma. She was a state senator. And this was back almost 30 years ago. And I said to her, you know, you're running for governor, and unfortunately as a woman, you know, you're going to be accused of being soft on crime because you're a woman, you know, that BS. She said, I'm not soft on crime. I'm the head of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, and I introduced capital punishment bill. And besides, I'm a victim of crime. When I heard a victim of crime, I said, okay, tell me about it. She said, well, I was walking down the street in my hometown, and somebody came along and ripped my pocket in my hand. I kicked off my shoes. I chased that person. I didn't catch him, but I was able to pick him out of a lineup, and he's in jail. Okay, so I do a spot where I got slow-mo. The hand comes, takes the pocketbook, kicks off her shoes, shows her running down after him, ends in a close-up of her, looks at the camera, says, some people say women are soft on crime, not this woman. Hmm. And she went from 3 to 47 in a week. Hmm. Now, the end of the story is that after she made the runoff, great upset, a enterprising reporter, Tulsa World, which is the leading newspaper in the state, wanted to find out about this victim of crime issue. He went to her hometown in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and found out it was a complete, total lie. She made the whole thing up. And she was dead. And she was dead. Now, did I ever think to ask her if that was the truth? Why would I think she'd tell me a lie? Then I go and do a TV spot on it, and the TV spot's incredibly effective, and then they found out she lied. And that was the end of her career.
What a nightmare. Oh, my God. So Jeremy's got some really good questions for you, but just one final from me. You know, Jesse Jackson, that's where you and I first connected, and then we have intersected over the years in various Cleveland, political races. But Jesse Jackson is the leader of a movement, and a strong personality. You have been credited with giving some organization to that. Hey, a presidential campaign, primaries in multiple states, lots of rules and stuff. I mean, what do you do? How do you go in and turn a movement and a charismatic leader into a solid organization? I mean, what are the sorts of things you have to do?
That's a really good question. By the way, the other person I met during that campaign was some guy named Jim Zocchi.
Yes, who I know very well, as you know.
Who I know you know very well, and he's a terrific guy. Anyway, well, I thought I was ready to run a campaign. Actually, my goal for 1988 was to put a presidential campaign for the governor of Ohio, Dick Celeste. That didn't happen. And I was ready. I mean, I understood what had to be done. I had run the state of Ohio for Jimmy Carter campaign. I'd been involved in presidential politics at various levels. And to be honest with you, the Jackson people couldn't find anybody to run the campaign. Everybody turned him down because he ran in 84, and that campaign was a joke. And I get this phone call asking me if I'd like to run Jesse's campaign for president. I said, no, I'm not interested. Why aren't you interested in it? Because it's, why would this be any different? And the response was that Willie Brown has agreed, he was a speaker at the time, has agreed to be the campaign chair, but only if Jesse will find a competent professional campaign manager. And Jesse said to Willie, go find me somebody. And I know you don't want to do this, but would you meet with Willie? Yeah, I'd meet with Willie Brown. So I flew out to California, met with Willie Brown. We hit it off. He said to me, why do you think a white guy can run a campaign for a black guy running for president? And my response was, excuse me, you're recruiting me. I don't want the job. That's the wrong question. We hit it off. He sent me to see Maxine Waters. And Maxine Waters was an assemblywoman at the time, and she's one of those people that you meet in life, and whatever side she's on, you want to be on her side. You don't want her against you in anything. And
no, absolutely.
And I met her, and eventually, you know, I decided to do it not because I felt Jackson was going to win the nomination, but I thought he would include people who were not normally included, because he went places that candidates usually didn't go. And, you know, we didn't win the nomination, but it was a very successful campaign, included, you know, thousands and thousands of people, raised a good deal of money. In 1984, his total communication expenditure was $10,000 for radio, and in 3.7 million dollars in certain states across the country. But you know, there's certain people that can do this and certain people that can't. I was ready, as led me to believe I was ready, and I proved I was ready and did a good job.
And you did. And it was successful, and did not win, but it was successful. Jeremy, you've got some great questions.
Yeah, I have one question. I've been listening, and one of the big talents that you have is you listen to the candidate and who they are, and then you project it as to how the public would find it appealing. But let's imagine a scenario where, we're a little bit closer to the 2024 election, and whoever the Democratic nominee is and whoever the Republican nominee is, they both call you. And now, of course, we don't know who these people will be, but we're looking at the political landscape and what's been developing. And we assume that, the similar trend carries on. What would your advice be to them in terms of style or what to communicate? In other words, what do you think would be a good strategy, and why?
Well, first of all, I would first employ the Roger Mudd strategy. I don't know if you remember Roger Mudd used to be a correspondent for CBS, and he did an interview with Kennedy. Kennedy, why do you want to run for president? And Ted Kennedy could not answer that question. So my first question would be, why do you want for president? I mean, it's not my vision of you running. I want to hear why you want to run for president, and then I want to hear why you think you could win. The problems, not problems, but what you deal with now that you didn't deal with years ago. News is instantaneous. I mean, I'm on this phone. I don't have to watch any nightly news tonight. I'm getting news instantaneously on this phone. That wasn't the case years ago. You have an organization like the Lincoln Project, which didn't exist years ago to do what they did in this past election. You now have a situation where someone like a Donald Trump, who never run for office before, winds up running and winning for president. Does that mean that other people who come from that ilk, meaning they've never been elected anything, they have a lot of money and they have some notoriety, decide that they want to
run? Yeah.
But the thing about it is, you want to find out if this person is lazy or not. Is this person a 9-to-5 person? When I say 9-to-5, I mean 9 a.m. to 5 a.m. Because it's exhausting to run for president. It's exhausting in terms of just on your body. It's exhausting on your mind. You get very little sleep. You don't eat real well. But you either get turned on by that or not. And there are people that have thought about running for president, and perhaps they would have been great president, but they couldn't run. You gotta be able to run to get elected. You're not appointed.
So let me just pivot the question a little bit. And say, given what has transpired since November, of course, we have the midterms ahead of us. But in terms of national campaign strategies and running campaigns, what are you hopeful about, and what are you concerned about?
Well, I'm more concerned than I am hopeful, and that's because I believe when I taught, I would tell this to my students: the campaign never ends. Mm-hmm. Election day may come, you may win, but the campaign never ends. Hmm. Well, we have someone in the White House right now who doesn't understand, the people around them don't understand the campaign never ends. And, you know, he's surrounded himself with a bunch of very, very talented, very bright people. They're all Washingtonians.
Yeah,
they may come from someplace else, but they've been in Washington so long, they wind up talking to each other. They don't talk to people out in the real world. I mean, Utica, New York, and Akron, Ohio, the real world. And they don't understand that the best, you know, defense is an offense. I mean, give you an example. They just passed the infrastructure bill. By the time it got passed, it seemed like it was the booby prize, because it was this amount, then this amount, then this amount. They finally passed it, which still was the largest amount of money ever allocated to infrastructure in the history of this country. Where does Joe Biden go to take his victory lap? Baltimore. Baltimore? You got a problem winning Maryland? You know, why aren't you out in Ohio? Why aren't you out in Iowa? Why aren't you out in Michigan? Candidates win or lose re-election during the time that they're serving. Even though Biden's already been there a year, he's now the president of the United States, meaning that COVID is on his watch. Afghanistan was on his watch. All these things are on his watch, even though a lot of it, you know, was you know, harmfully done by his predecessor.
So I actually did end up having a few questions. I only thought I was going to have one, but listening to you is fascinating. Do you think we're ripe for a third party?
No.
No.
No, I don't think we're ready for a third party. Well, you know, I should correct that. I think we do have a third party right now. There's the Democrats. There's whatever the Republicans think they are, and then there's the Trumpsters. You know, and there may actually be three parties or two major parties, the Democrats and the Trumpsters, and the whatever Republicans are right now, you know, they may be the third party.
Well, Jerry, what you've done here, not only in your career, but what you've done here in this book and its predecessor, True Tales from the Campaign Trail, is, you know, presented us with not only fascinating stories that kind of remind me of Mark Twain in many ways, but also some very important lessons. And it's more than just politics. It's about how we get to understand people. How we get to work through a political system, and how we win, and then what we do when we do win. I really thank you for coming in. I'm hoping closer to the election cycle in 2022, maybe we can bring you back and assess, you know, the Democrats' chances and the Republicans' chances. Would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely.
My pleasure. Oh, that's great. That was the right answer, incidentally. Jerry, thanks so much. The book is up on the screen. It is available on Amazon. And Jerry Austin, True Tales from the Campaign Trail. Thanks so much for
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Thanks, Jerry. You too. And we'll be talking soon, I'm sure.
Take care. Bye.
Yeah, thanks.
Take care. Bye.